Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the October 25th, 2024 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week shows Donald Trump. He is in a witch's costume. He's standing behind a kettle of boiling liquid, green. It's bubbling up, steaming up green. It's kind of lighting his face, a scary-looking green. Behind him are a variety of goons and goblins. There's a skeleton with a black cape, a couple of bats flying over. The headline is Conjuring Demons, Trump's Vow to Crush the Enemy Within. That is our first main story. We'll start right there. Trump ramps up threats against political enemies. What happened? With 3 weeks to go until Election Day, Donald Trump took a turn toward overt authoritarianism this week, escalating his anti-immigrant rhetoric, branding his political opponents as evil, and saying federal troops should be deployed against them. During a Fox News interview, Trump responded to a question about Election Day interference by foreign agitators by saying, "The bigger problem is the enemy from within." He cited radical left lunatics, including Representative Adam Schiff, who led the prosecution in Trump's first impeachment trial. "It should be very easily handled by, if necessary, by the National Guard, or if really necessary, by the military," he said. At a Fox News town hall on women's issues in Georgia, Trump said domestic enemies, including, you know, the Pelosis, these people, are a worse threat than China or Russia. "They're Marxist and communist and fascist," he said. "They're so sick and they're so evil." At a rally in Aurora, Colorado, Trump called the city a war zone, falsely claiming that gangs of Venezuelan migrants had taken over residential buildings in the Denver suburb. "I will rescue Aurora and every town that has been invaded and conquered," he declared. Vice President Kamala Harris has imported an army of migrant criminals from the dungeons of the Third World, he said, and sent them into your community. Speaking in Reno, Nevada, Trump made the false claim that migrants were crossing the border with weapons more sophisticated than those carried by U.S. soldiers, and predicted things would end unpleasantly for them. Polls continued to show a deadlocked race, with only a point or two separating the candidates in each of seven swing states. Some showed slight gains for Trump. An NBC News national poll had the pair tied 48-48, a five-point gain for the GOP nominee since last month. Harris called Trump increasingly unstable and unhinged. At an eerie Pennsylvania rally, she played video clips of Trump's enemy from within comments and his recent declaration that police could solve America's crime problem with one violent day. "Trump is out for unchecked power," said the Democratic nominee. In an interview in Detroit with Charlemagne Tha God, the popular radio host with Trump's platform, "is about fascism. Why can't we just say it?" Harris responded. "Yes, we can say that." What that editorial said: "Voters must take Trump's rhetoric seriously and literally," said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. "Some Americans tell themselves he's just showboating when he bellows dehumanizing insults, toxic lies, and second-term plans that sound like the schemes of a 1930s expiring dictator. Voters should heed the recent warning of General Mark Milley, whom Trump handpicked to head the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that the former president is fascist to the core and a five-alarm threat to America. Or they could just listen to Trump's increasingly alarming threats, which prove he belongs nowhere near power." For a chilling preview of how a reelected Trump would carry out his autocratic plans, Examine Project 2025, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. The 920-page document from the Arch Conservative Heritage Foundation details a scheme to round up and deport millions of immigrants, stock the federal bureaucracy with MAGA loyalists, dismantle the FBI, and put the Justice Department under Trump's thumb. It would upend fundamental freedoms by barring same-sex marriage and wiping out protections for LGBTQ people. Under Project 2025, if Trump wins, everyone else loses. What the columnist said. As Election Day looms, Trump's racist anti-immigrant messaging is getting darker, said Maya Ward in Politico. He's zeroed in on the closing argument that Americans are under assault from animals with bad genes who are pouring over the border, and that only he can save the nation. Experts say such xenophobic rhetoric is straight from the authoritarian playbook. These are not just Nazi-like statements, said Robert Jones, founder of the Public Religion Research Institute. These are actual Nazi sentiments. There's a political strategy at work here, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. The conventional wisdom is that Trump must temper his message so as not to alienate likely voters who are undecided. But he's targeting a different audience, low-information Americans who typically don't vote, but might be persuaded to if they believe America's very existence depends on it. He can court them with celebrations of bigotry, crudeness, and violence, while resting secure normie Republicans will back him no matter what. Meanwhile, Trump benefits from a strange phenomenon, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. Even as he loudly and publicly vows to deploy troops against American citizens, remake the federal government, and launch a campaign of retribution against political adversaries, many voters don't believe he'll actually follow through. It's unfathomable to a significant share of the nation that Trump really wants to implement such extremist ideas, even though all indicators suggest he does. Another hard truth is increasingly undeniable, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Like many, I assume that once Trump showed his fascistic tendencies on the trail, appalled voters would recoil. But that's not what's happening. Trump is now running a flagrantly fascist campaign backed by half the electorate, and it's increasingly hard to believe they're unaware of exactly what they're voting for. If he wins, that shocking reality will hit the rest of us like an asteroid. And no one is prepared, I think, for how profound the impact will be. And we'll read the second main story. FEMA struggles as costs of hurricane relief mount. What happened? President Biden visited Central Florida this week to survey the damage wreaked by Hurricane Milton. As the soaring toll of the South's back-to-back storms, which could exceed $200 billion, began to strain the resources of federal disaster relief agencies. Hurricane Helene, which killed at least 228 people when it battered the region last month, knocked out water services to part of western North Carolina. Hospitals and schools in Asheville are digging their own wells, while residents rely on donated jugs of water to flush their toilets. It is an extreme health crisis looming if we don't get these toilets flushed, volunteer L. DeBrule told NPR. FEMA workers were providing assistance across the region, but briefly suspended work amid rumors of armed militias threatening them. In Central Florida, Milton killed at least 25 people last week and spawned dozens of tornadoes and 15-foot floods. Speaking in front of a collapsed house in St. Pete Beach, Biden announced $600 million in aid for storm victims, saying the government would help them not just recover, but build back stronger. Yet federal funds are already running low. Allocated $20 billion in disaster fund relief for the fiscal year that began in October 1st, FEMA spent more than half that sum in the first 2 weeks. The Small Business Administration, which has received some 50,000 applications from those affected by the two hurricanes, is totally out of money and said it would have to halt loans until Congress approved more funding. But Congress is out of session until November 12th, and House Speaker Mike Johnson has ignored bipartisan calls to reconvene it so it can pass emergency aid. It would be premature to call everyone back now, he said, adding that Congress would eventually approve the appropriate amount. What the editorial said. Another hurricane, another day after, and still more than a month left in the storm season, said the Palm Beach Post. Floridians barely had time to survey the damage from Helene before Milton plowed through, forcing us to hunker down or evacuate again. Debris from the first storm became projectiles in the second. In St. Petersburg, a crane crashed through a high-rise. While the emphasis is now on recovery, we'll soon have to focus on building resiliency. We can't keep doing this. These hurricanes don't just hurt the locals, said the Las Vegas Sun. They have ripple effects across the U.S. Hospitals all over the country are currently delaying surgeries because a key maker of IV fluid products, Baxter International's plant in Marion, North Carolina, flooded during Helene. FEMA does a heroic service in helping communities recover, but what about industries? We need to revamp our whole emergency response program and substantially enlarge FEMA's capabilities. What the columnist said. In this time of national crisis, Republicans are holding American disaster relief hostage, said Chris Brennan in USA Today. Johnson flatly refused to reconvene Congress so that FEMA can get the funds it needs. He'd rather campaign for Donald Trump, the very candidate spreading the lie that emergency aid funds have been spent on illegal immigrants. Apparently, the needs of hurricane victims must wait until after the election. Yet Floridians can't wait. Their bills are mounting now, said Rob Weil in NBCNews.com. Most of them don't have any flood insurance at all, while those who do are largely covered by the state's public flood insurer, which is teetering toward insolvency. Florida homeowner insurance premiums, meanwhile, have skyrocketed, in some places shooting up 400% in the last 5 years. Frustrated, some residents are pulling up stakes. I'm done, said Nicole Fontaine, whose Siesta Key home flooded in both storms. I love it, I'll visit it, but I don't want to live it anymore. This will only get worse, said Tony Rahm in the Washington Post. Climate calamities are becoming more frequent, deadly, and costly in a country already facing massive fiscal challenges. America once experienced so-called billion-dollar disasters just a few times per year. In 2024, they happened every 3 weeks. Congress can't seem to find just a few billion right now, yet we're projected to need over $128 billion annually to respond to hurricanes, wildfires, and other climate emergencies. With the national debt topping $35 trillion, that's a recipe for another disaster. Controversy of the week. Harris, can she win back wavering black Latino voters? Black Americans have historically been unflinching supporters of the Democratic Party, said Maya King in the New York Times. Yet there is growing alarm that lukewarm black enthusiasm for Vice President Kamala Harris could cost her next month's election. Harris this week unleashed a blitz of national media interviews and campaign ads aimed at black voters, and in Pennsylvania unveiled a policy agenda targeted heavily at black men, 20% of whom plan to vote for Donald Trump, according to a recent poll. Overall, Harris still leads Trump among black voters by 78% to 15%, but that's a sharp drop-off from the 87% who supported Joe Biden in 2020. And could doom her fortunes in a close election. Harris has a similar problem with Latino voters, said Julio Ricardo Varela in MSNBC.com. They support Harris 54% to 40%, 61% voted for Biden in 2020. And the Latino gender gap is even wider. Among Latino men ages 35 to 49 in the swing states of Nevada and Arizona, Harris trails Trump by 14 points and 20 points, respectively. The Democrat needs to stop that gap from growing. And while the Hombres con Harris outreach effort she launched last week is smart, it comes very, very late. Harris polling panic is understandable, said Zachary Faria in the Washington Examiner. But her campaign's toxic identitarianism won't help. Voters recognize pandering when they see it and will resent the implication that they're obligated to vote for Harris because of their skin color. For sheer condescension, nothing tops former President Barack Obama in Pittsburgh last week, said Paul Butler in the Washington Post. The scolder-in-chief accused black men of coming up with all kinds of excuses to not support Harris, when the real reason, apparently, is we aren't feeling the idea of having a woman as president. Sorry, but insulting black men as sexist pigs is a bizarre way to try to win their votes. Is black men's reconsideration of the Democratic Party really surprising? Asked Charles Coleman Jr. in the New York Times. While successive Democratic administrations have paid lip service to our priorities, police reform, closing the racial wealth gap, black men get little real attention from policymakers. The opportunity agenda for black men, Harris released this week, with its offers of business loans and jobs in the legal marijuana industry, amounts to a vision of less last that's unlikely to have us flocking to the polls. As for Latinos, said Michael Barreen in the Liberal Patriot, many simply feel they were better off economically under Trump. Majority do not believe Trump is referring to them when he rants about immigrants poisoning the blood of America. And many support his plans to finish the border wall, 43%, and mass deport those here illegally, 45%. This isn't about loyalty, said Perry Bacon Jr. in the Washington Post. Blacks and Latinos should stick with the Democrats out of pure self-interest. Under Democratic presidents from the 1970s on, black and Latino family incomes grew $1,000 and $800 a year, respectively, compared with $335 and $100 under Republicans. Harris' outreach to non-white voters is welcome, said Naya Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. But the real problem that needs solving is not the black men who make up a sliver of the electorate and will overwhelmingly vote for Harris. It's the white people who make up 80% of voters in a swing state like Michigan, a majority of whom will vote for Trump against all of our interests. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for exciting new chapters. After Ryan Salami, Sam Bankman-Fried's lieutenant at collapsed crypto fraud firm FTX, announced on LinkedIn that I'm happy to share that I'm starting a new position as inmate at FCI Cumberland. Salami joins a team of more than 1,000 felons at the federal prison for an engagement expected to last 7 years, 6 months. It's a good week for useful idiots. After former Hollywood action star turned Russian immigrant Steven Seagal, 72, released a new documentary in which he declares his willingness to fight in Ukraine and die if need be for Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin has not yet responded to Seagal's offer. It was a good week for panda diplomacy after two giant pandas from China arrived at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., a year after the zoo's last three bears were returned to their homeland. A Chinese official expressed hope that Bao Li and King Bao, both three and fluffy, will help stabilize U.S.-China relations. But it was a bad week for dressing provocatively after a man in a red and white striped shirt flagged down police in Tybee Island, Georgia, to complain he'd been verbally assaulted by a stranger shouting, "Where's Waldo?" The victim appeared highly intoxicated, according to a police report. was a bad week for grandmasters. After chess pro Kirill Shevchenko, ranked 69th in the world, was booted from a Spanish tournament for allegedly using a phone hidden in a bathroom to cheat. Shevchenko, 22, aroused suspicion with his frequent mid-game toilet trips. A phone was found in a stall together with a note in his handwriting that read, "Don't touch." Finally, it was a bad week for misdirection after an Oregon man and woman were arrested when police discovered a bag full of illegal drugs labeled "Definitely not a bag full of drugs" during a traffic stop. 3 months earlier, a Florida woman had been arrested with a bag of drugs labeled "bag of drugs." The briefing this week, nature versus nurture. Pit bulls have a vicious reputation. Are the dogs or bad owners to blame? How dangerous are pit bulls? Despite making up 6% of the U.S. dog population, pit bulls are responsible for 22.5% of dog attacks, more than any other breed, according to a 2019 study that examined five decades of research. And of the 521 Americans killed by dogs from 2015 to 2019, 66% were attacked by pit bulls, reports the nonprofit victims group dogbite.org. Two fatal attacks occurred last week. A one-year-old in Texas was mauled to death by his babysitter's three pit bulls, with a sheriff saying the animals played a minutes-long tug-of-war with the boy's bloodified body. Days later, a pack of 10 pit bull mixes killed a 59-year-old man in a backyard in Albany, New York, only stopping when a police officer shot dead one of the dogs. Pit bull owners say such incidents are largely the result of bad owners. Pit bull-type dogs are innately no more likely to bite or attack humans, said Sarah Andreco, founder of the American Pit Bull Foundation. If they are mistreated, then that can lead to serious problems. But Colleen Lynn, president of dogbite.org, argues that these stocky animals, which can weigh from 30 to 90 pounds, are a risk to people because they have been specifically bred with incredible aggression and fight. What were pit bulls originally bred to do? Fight other dogs. Modern pit bulls, a loose grouping that includes the Staffordshire Bull Terrier and the American Pit Bull Terrier, descend from the old English bulldogs used in bear and bull baiting. In those blood sports, dogs would try to subdue the larger animals by biting its snout and dragging it to the ground. When those sports were outlawed in Britain in the early 1800s, breeders mixed their bulldogs with terriers to create a more agile canine better suited for dog fighting. Experts say that fighting heritage can still be seen in pit bulls today in their large, strong jaws, muscular neck and shoulders, and behavior. The animals seem to have a high threshold for pain, often don't growl or give warning that they're about to strike, and have a stubborn hold-and-shake bite style that can shred tissue and break bones. 2020 study that looked at 182 people admitted to trauma centers with dog bite injuries to the face found that, compared with other breeds, pit bull terriers inflicted more complex wounds and that their attacks were often unprovoked. Pit bull advocates argue that research, in fact, shows the dogs are unfairly maligned. What evidence do they cite? They point to studies conducted by the American Temperament Test Society, which has put tens of thousands of dogs through drills to assess their aggressiveness, stability, and friendliness around people. About 88% of American Pit Bull Terriers put through the test have passed, a higher share than for bearded collies, beagles, and Dalmatians. Some canine experts also cast doubt on pit bull data because DNA studies indicate that bull mastiffs, boxers, and other breeds that have pit bull-like muscular bodies, square heads, and short ears are often mistaken for the animals. Still, what is accepted is that pit bulls are often bred for musculature and that their fierce reputation means they are more likely to be bred and owned by people who will encourage aggressiveness. They want to pack heat via their dog, so to speak, said animal behaviorist Nicholas Dodman. The dogs had a very different reputation a century ago. How were they viewed back then? In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, pit bull type dogs were regarded as loving all-American family pets. Helen Keller, Mark Twain, and President Theodore Roosevelt all owned one, and the animals were especially popular among the working class. The sturdy, loyal dogs were seen as a symbol of pure tenacity and American fortitude and individualism, said Bronwyn Dickey, author of Pit Bull, The Battle Over an American Icon. But in the 1970s and 80s, pit bulls lost their family-friendly image and came to be seen, as Time put it, as time bombs on legs. What changed? A surge in urban crime led to a boom in very fly-by-night businesses selling unstable pit bulls as guard dogs, said Dickey. Reports of dog bites spiked in big cities. Meanwhile, dogfighting grew in both popularity and brutality, with owners using steroids, amphetamines, and cattle prods to heighten aggression. A humane campaign led the blood sport to be banned in all 50 states by 1976, and attention then turned to the threat posed by the fighting dogs. In 1980, the city of Hollywood, Florida, issued the nation's first pit bull ban after a dog tore the face of a 7-year-old boy. Hundreds more breed-specific laws followed. It's not clear whether they are effective. Some unscrupulous dog owners get around the bans by switching to more powerful breeds. In 2020, Denver scrapped its 3-decade-old pit bull ban, which a study found had delivered negligible improvements in public safety, but cost $100 million to enforce. Yet in the first year after the ban was nixed, city data showed that pit bulls were responsible for more bites on people, 117, than any other breed. What could be done to curb attacks? Some animal rights groups, including PETA, say all pit bulls should be spayed and neutered to curb the breed's population. Others want more education for people who buy or adopt a pit bull, emphasizing the need to never leave children unsupervised with the animal, for example, and for authorities to crack down on negligent owners. But pediatric plastic surgeon Michael Golinko, who has operated on numerous children attacked by pit bulls, believes that phasing out the dogs through bans is the best policy. "I'd much rather be on that side of the argument," he said, "advocating for a child's safety than for the rights of an owner of a pretty dangerous animal." Time for a few of the best columns. Our first two come from the U.S. The likelihood of another red mirage. It's almost certain that Donald Trump will prematurely claim victory on election night due to the red mirage, said Ed Kilgore. Trump did so 4 years ago as early voting results on November 3rd showed he narrowly led Joe Biden when the polls closed. These tallies disproportionately represented in-person Republican votes in a year when 46% of the electorate voted by mail-in ballot because of the COVID pandemic. Trump's red mirage disappeared as millions of mailed votes were counted in battleground states. He cried election fraud and even asked the Supreme Court to stop the count of late votes. For this election, the percentage of voters using mail ballots will be down from 2020, but the partisan gap will persist. 42% of Harris voters plan to vote by mail, compared with just 20% of Trump supporters. Mail votes usually take longer to count, so is there any doubt Trump will declare victory when the polls close and insist that counting cease? He's already claimed that millions of Democratic votes will be fraudulent, and his campaign plans to challenge ballots and voters it considers suspect, delaying result certifications. A majority of his supporters will believe he's won, triggering another election denial saga. Trans issues may cost Democrats. A big sleeper issue in this year's election may be the Democrats' support for transgender athletes competing against girls, said the Wall Street Journal. In a Gallup poll last year, 69% of Americans agreed that transgender athletes should only be allowed to compete on sports teams that conform with their birth gender. That's not bigotry. It's a matter of fairness and common sense. Most parents feel that it's not right for their daughters to compete against athletes who were born male and therefore enjoy a distinct biological advantage. But progressives have fallen in line with the radical contention of transgender activists that gender is purely subjective and can be flipped like a switch. The issue is becoming a significant factor in many Senate and House races. Vulnerable Democratic Senators Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, and John Tester of Montana are all under heavy Republican fire for their support of trans athletes in girls' sports. "Those aren't Montana values," said one frequently played ad criticizing Tester. "Majority of Americans resent having left-wing gender ideology imposed on them." Though progressives consider the trans issue out of bounds, it just might cost Democrats control of Congress. This column comes from Japan. A warning from the survivors. "Has the world forgotten how unfathomably destructive nuclear weapons are?" asked Asahi Shimbun. In 1945, when the U.S. dropped the only nuclear bombs used in war, tens of thousands of people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were incinerated immediately, and tens of thousands more died slowly over the ensuing weeks of radiation sickness or of excruciating burns. Survivors in both cities rose from the nuclear wasteland to tell the world what had happened, to make sure it would never happen again. Now, Nihon Hidankyo, the survivors' collective that has waged a decades-long campaign to rid the world of these ghastly weapons, has won the Nobel Peace Prize. This recognition comes at a time when the international community urgently needs a reminder of the peril we all face. While many believe the risk of a nuclear war abated after the Cold War ended, in fact, the number of active warheads is once again growing. We are seeing an unending chain of foolish actions by nuclear-armed countries. Russia has openly embraced nuclear blackmail as a means to gain control over its neighbors. China, which isn't bound by any nuclear arms pact, is rapidly expanding its arsenal. And as the Japanese survivors grow older and pass away, their message must be heard. Nuclear bombs cannot be allowed to fly once again. Another catastrophe is imminent. Time for the last word, or feature article. Searching for the October surprise. Reporter Craig Unger's career was nearly destroyed when he started investigating a possible election conspiracy, said Gal Beckerman in The Atlantic. 3 decades later, he's still at it. The obsession that would overtake Craig Unger's life, get him labeled as a member of the Tinfoil Hat Brigade, and nearly destroy his career as an investigative reporter, took root on an April morning in 1991. Scanning the New York Times and drinking his coffee, he came upon an op-ed detailing a treasonous plot that had sabotaged Jimmy Carter's re-election efforts a decade earlier, a plot that would become known, somewhat ironically, as the October Surprise. Gary Sick, a former Iran specialist on the National Security Council, was alleging that during the 1980 presidential campaign, while more than 50 Americans were being held hostage in Iran, Ronald Reagan's team made a backroom arms deal with the new Islamic Republic to delay the hostages' release until after the election. Carter, bedeviled by the international fiasco, would be denied the narrative he needed to save his sinking chances. An October surprise, that is. And Reagan could announce the Americans' freedom just after he was sworn in, which he went on to do. This story was literally unimaginable, Unger writes in his new book, Den of Spies, a crime of the highest order. He was hooked. Speaking with me about the October surprise from a leather booth at a Greenwich Village tavern more than three decades later, Unger, now 75, lit up. Uncovering exactly how Republican operatives had improbably and secretly worked out an agreement with Ayatollah Khomeini would give him a chance to be Woodward and Bernstein, or Seymour Hersh, journalistic heroes whose crusading investigations he revered. But it would not be Unger's Watergate. It would be his undoing. Within a year, the story was downgraded to a hoax, and Unger was both out of a job at Newsweek and being sued for $10 million. He had become, he writes, toxic. Unger is what anyone would call an old-school reporter. His instincts were formed during the Watergate era, when the public's reflexive trust in government was high, somewhere near 70% before Richard Nixon took office, as opposed to about 20% today. And journalists began fashioning themselves as adversaries with the presumption that the worst abuses of power were happening behind closed doors. Their role was to break Americans' credulity, and they did. When I met Unger in mid-September, a second apparent attempt on Donald Trump's life had just occurred. I asked him for his first thought. Cui bono, he said. Who benefits from it? He wasn't saying it had been a false flag operation, but he definitely started from the premise that it might have been. The alleged linchpin of the October surprise was William Casey, Reagan's campaign manager through most of 1980. Casey was the head of secret intelligence for Europe in the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA, during World War II, and for the rest of his life maintained a broad network of contacts among the spies and dodgy arms dealers of the world. He was a furtive, mumbly man, a Manichaean thinker, a cold warrior, and, as Unger put it to me, a dazzlingly brilliant spy. Casey also seemed to have few scruples about doing what was needed to win. He was accused of having obtained Carter's debate briefing papers during the 1980 campaign, and once the election was over, Casey was made director of the CIA. After Sick's 1991 op-ed, every major news publication sought to follow up and investigate. Most of the reporting focused on whether Casey was present at meetings in Madrid at the end of July 1980, when the plan was supposedly hatched. Endless minutiae surrounded this question. Unger showed me a copy of an attendance chart from a conference in London around the end of July, at which Casey was a participant. For the 2 days he was supposedly in Madrid for the meetings, some of the check marks on the chart indicating his presence in London are in light pencil, not in pen, meaning that he was expected but possibly never showed. Did he sneak off to Spain? Anyone can see this, right? Unger said, squinting at the chart. The pieces of this puzzle were that tiny, or they involved shady characters who said they were at the Madrid meetings, or their follow-ups, and could attest to the plotting. People such as the brothers Cyrus and Jamshid Hashimi, Iranian businessmen who were acting, Unger alleges, as double agents, pretending to negotiate the hostage release with Carter while working with Casey to stall it for Reagan's benefit. Unger, who had been a freelance investigative reporter, was hired by Newsweek shortly after Esquire published his first article on the October surprise to join a team dedicated to tracking down the plot. Like Woodward and Bernstein on Watergate, Unger imagined the team would do a series of stories leading eventually all the way to the White House. As with Watergate and other conspiracy investigations of varying credibility, whether the cigarette industry's cover-up or Iraq's purported weapons of mass destruction, this one relied on Rogue's gallery of sources. Unger made contact with Ari Ben Menashe, an arms dealer who claimed to be an intelligence asset for the Israeli Military Intelligence Directorate. Ben Menashe gave Unger details about the deal and described Casey's participation. Newsweek was not interested in an incremental Watergate-like build. Instead of Unger scoops, they published an article about how Ben Menashe was a liar who had helped invent the story of the October surprise. Other publications followed. Unger was soon out at Newsweek. Then he and Esquire were sued for libel by Robert Bud McFarlane, Reagan's national security advisor. The case was thrown out, and McFarlane lost his subsequent appeal. Two congressional investigators looking into the plot were launched in the early 1990s. The House produced a nearly 1,000-page report. Both inquiries concluded that no proof of a conspiracy existed. According to the chair of the House task force, the whole story was the product of sources who were either wholesale fabricators or were impeached by documentary evidence. In the years since that first op-ed was published, a lot of other testimony and evidence had helped bolster the October surprise theory, some of it from more reliable sources. Notably, Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, the president of Iran in 1980, who insisted to anyone who would listen that he had been aware of the plot. And just last year, the New York Times published a bombshell report in which Ben Barnes, a prominent Texas politician, revealed a secret he had been keeping for nearly 43 years. In 1980, he traveled throughout the Middle East with John Connally, the former Texas governor, seemingly at the behest of Casey, to ask Arab leaders to persuade Iran to delay the hostage release. The odds that Unger will get a renewed hearing for the October surprise are low. We now live in a country where politicians seem to openly brag about lying, and enough people despise the media so much they're willing to believe those lies anyway. Detailing a nearly half-century-old conspiracy theory, even with Unger's massive evidence, the receipts, a videotaped interview with Jamshid Hashimi, those little pencil check marks on an old attendance chart would read like old news to one half of the country and a partisan revisionism to the other half. I wondered, though, in my discussions with Unger, whether reporters like him bore some of the responsibility, whether the kind of skepticism and mistrust that marked his generation of journalists had helped create our post-truth reality. There were moments when he slipped from crusading truth-teller to something closer to a conspiracy theorist willing to believe the most outlandish speculations. In the book, for example, with very little proof, he entertains the idea that rogue spies looking to undermine Carter sabotaged the helicopters used in a failed hostage rescue mission in April 1980, which ended with 8 soldiers dying in a crash. I asked Unger whether he really believed this. "Well, I think it's a possibility," he told me. It was easier to sympathize with Unger, to see the genuine idealism behind the swagger, when he explained why he couldn't ever let go of the theory that had so hobbled his career. He grew up in Dallas. His father was an endocrinologist, and his mother owned the biggest independent bookstore in the city. Unger told me about a visit he took to the Dachau concentration camp when he was 14 in 1963. This was instead of a bar mitzvah. While there, he saw Germans atoning for their national sins, not even 20 years after the end of the war, and it stayed with him, that honest reckoning with the past. He told me it made him think of his city's own Robert E. Lee Park, named after the Confederate general and defender of slavery, and how shameful it was that so long after the end of the Civil War, Lee's name was unapologetically honored. When my colleagues and I first took on the October Surprise more than 30 years ago, we became actors in a case study of America's denial of its dark history, its refusal to accept the ugly truth, Unger writes in his book. After Unger told me the story about his childhood in Lee Park, I looked up the green space and saw that it had been renamed Turtle Creek Park in 2019. Ugly truths, even America, do occasionally get acknowledged, but it can take longer than one journalist's lifetime for that to happen. This was adapted from an article first published in The Atlantic. We'll pick up a couple of the health and science articles this week. A leap forward in neuroscience. Scientists have mapped the millions of infinitesimal connections in a fruit fly brain, a landmark achievement that could pave the way for unprecedented insights into how the human brain works. The fly's poppy seed-sized brain is tremendously complex. More than 140,000 neurons are joined together with 50 million connections. Researchers began the multi-year project by slicing the organ into 7,000 thin slivers, then imaging each section with an electron microscope. They used artificial intelligence to analyze the structures, some as small as 4 millionths of a millimeter wide, and then recruited a global army of hundreds of scientists and volunteers to help correct the AI's errors. The resulting wiring diagram has already led to significant discoveries, reports The Guardian. Researchers have identified interrogator neurons, which appear to combine different types of information, as well as broadcasters, which send out signals to coordinate activity. While the technology isn't yet there to map the wiring on a human brain, with its 86 billion neurons and trillions of connections, a project to do the same for a mouse brain should be complete in 5 to 10 years. You might be asking why we should care about the brain of a fruit fly, says study co-leader Sebastian Sung from Princeton University. My simple answer is that if we can truly understand how any brain functions, it's bound to tell us something about all brains. Termite City from Neanderthal Era. The southern harvester termite mounds found on the west coast of South Africa and Namibia are phenomenal feats of engineering. Constructed from dirt, saliva, and feces, they contain vast labyrinths of nests, tunnels, and chambers that extend 11 feet underground. Now a new study has found that some of these little hills are up to 34,000 years old, a staggering age given the previous record holder, a mound in Brazil, is just 4,000 years old. Over the millennia, the insects have built up a hard layer of calcite to protect against aardvarks. If there is a breach, it is quickly resealed. When we dig a soil profile that breaks any part of the mound, we see that the termite soldiers and workers switch into a sort of emergency mode and appear almost instantly, lead author Michelle Francis from Stellenbosch University in South Africa tells the New York Times. The soldiers guard the tunnels and the workers do the repair work. The little hills may also help combat climate change by trapping carbon, since much of the plant matter the termites eat ends up bound to minerals. Each mound can sequester about 15 tons of carbon. And we'll pick up one of the Talking Points articles. Musk, why he's gone dark MAGA. As he morphs into a Bond villain, Elon Musk has developed a diabolical plot for a global takeover, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer. The world's richest man has thrown his pile of loot and growing influence behind the authoritarian Donald Trump, donning a black hat, calling himself Dark MAGA, dancing and fawning over Trump at a Pennsylvania rally, and pouring at least $80 million into his pro-Trump PAC. Musk has also turned his social media platform, X, into a pro-Trump bullhorn. He's posted about Trump more than 100 times and has aggressively promoted right-wing conspiracies to his 200 million followers, including false claims that Jews and Democrats are importing immigrants to engage in massive voter fraud. In return, Trump has promised to appoint Musk head of government efficiency, giving him the authority to axe thousands of federal jobs and reshape Washington. For all to see, Musk is engaged in a brazen attempt to buy the American government. Musk used to be a progressive, said Nick Bilton in Vanity Fair, but made this ideological pivot for deeply personal reasons. He began moving to the right when California Democratic officials forced him to close his Tesla plants during the early days of the COVID pandemic, and then was truly radicalized in 2022 when his transgender adult child severed ties with her unsupportive father. Musk later said that losing his son ignited his desire to destroy the woke mind virus. Musk has joined a growing group of anti-woke ex-Democrats, which includes the likes of Tulsi Gabbard and Robert F. Kennedy Jr., said Rich Lowry in National Review. They are refugees from the lunacy of the left and see Trump as an antidote to the stifling orthodoxy of modern progressivism. Musk is only pretending to be anti-establishment, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. He and Trump have both found, to their dismay and anger, that their wealth cannot buy respect. They figured out, however, that they can get the attention and admiration they so desperately need by pandering to class, racial, and cultural resentments, and posing as champions of free speech and the little guy. But make no mistake, if these Pluto populists are in charge, life will only become harder for everyone who isn't wealthy or powerful. In the end, the joke is always on the voters. Media, a too tough interview on Israel? Journalists are supposed to ask tough questions, said Ruth Marcus. But a co-host on CBS Mornings has raised a firestorm at his own network for the sin of committing good journalism. It started when celebrated author Ta-Nehisi Coates visited the show to promote his new book, The Message, which likens Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank to that of blacks in Jim Crow America. In a tense 7-minute interview, co-host Tony DeCoupel, who is Jewish, asked Coates why he included no reference to Israel being surrounded by enemies bent on its destruction or to Israeli children blown to bits in terrorist attacks. What is it that so particularly offends you about the existence of a Jewish state, he asked. After offended staffers raised an uproar, CBS News officials rebuked DeCoupel, saying he'd failed to meet editorial standards. How cowardly, said Matthew Hennessy. Network execs wilted under pressure from self-righteous woke upstarts whose anti-Israel views were challenged and who don't understand what a real journalist does. Coates was the one asking really tough questions, said Karen Atia in the Washington Post. Saying he wants to speak for those who don't have a voice, the author asked why we should accept policies subjugating people based on race and ethnicity anywhere in the world. DeCupo wouldn't answer, and he set the terms of the debate in troubling fashion, opening by saying Coates' book would not be out of place in the backpack of an extremist. When humanizing Palestinians is recast as a form of extremism, we are in dangerous territory. Coach should not have been served only softball questions, said Andrea Williams, but he deserved a civil discourse, not a one-sided attack. But this was a civil discourse, said Robbie Sove. It might not have been standard morning show fluff, but an opinionated host grilled an opinionated guest known for provocative writings on race. An unruffled Coates held his own. The pair had a substantive exchange, and viewers can make up their own minds about it. That's what journalism is supposed to look like, and to call it a lapse of journalistic integrity is ridiculous. While several CBS employees shed tears at an internal meeting about DeCupo matter, Coates himself said he wasn't angered by the interview, and in truth, he probably welcomed it. After all, nothing sells books quite like controversy. And one short note, September was the bloodiest month for Russia since the start of the war in Ukraine, with U.S. and British military analysts putting Russian casualties at more than 1,200 a day. More than 648,000 Russian troops have been injured or killed since the February 2022 invasion. Quick quote from Bruce Springsteen, I have spent my life judging the distance between American reality and the American dream. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.